Now we're looking south. They're finishing off their movie, which is a 25-minute movie with just a panoramic spread, sort of say goodbye to the place. There were many trails, but we built the fire roads. There's the castle. Mm-hmm. They loved it. The children in particular, whom I've talked to, loved it. There's the pink house. You know that the Strakes added to the pink house. They made it into this Y shape. Of course, now see that? I want you to remember that, and I'll talk about it. And then here's the bell. And then we're about to finish, probably. Mm-hmm. The end. Thank you. Now, what you saw there on top of the red rocks, it was the red rocks down by the international office. And if you go and stand in the international car park where we park our cars today, and you look up in that direction at the red rocks, you can see a stump, like a finger, about 3 feet high, just standing on top of the rocks. That's the only part that's left of that magnificent Eagle weather vane, which, as Len has probably told you, was stolen in the late 1960s, I believe. But it, we have a picture of it. It was well over 6 foot high, and it was an important part of General Palmer's weather monitoring system. He had a lot of these rocks wired up with climate measurement devices. So that eagle is a great loss, and someone has it, no doubt, in their garden, enjoying it now. Okay, that just gives you a little feeling. I need to show that to Cato de Felice, don't I, of what we can recover. Yeah. Nikola Tesla. Mm. Interesting. He was in this city from 1899 to 1900. May I digress? You prompt me. In the latter part of the 19th century, two men vied for having the most patents, Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla. Guess who won? Tesla. He has more than 900 patents for electricity. He was the discoverer of alternating current. He discovered it around 1880 in the city of Strasbourg. He was the son of a priest from Serbia. And he came to Strasbourg. He discovered a machinery for producing alternating current. He came and he became one of Thomas Edison's employees in the USA. They argued ferociously because Edison was radically committed to direct current. The battle, the field of battle for them was Niagara Falls. Tesla got on his side Mr. Westinghouse. Mr. Westinghouse got the contract to build the turbines for Niagara, alternating current. Edison somewhat receded into the background. He was still promoting direct current, but Tesla's alternating current demonstrated itself in the power that was produced from Niagara Falls. Tesla then came to Colorado Springs. He lived here for about 18 months. The International Tesla Society is situated out there, somewhere off Platt. And what he did here was experiment with lightning. And he produced, well, why did he come to Colorado to experiment with lightning? Little known fact about Colorado, it is the lightning capital of the world. There is more lightning that takes place in Colorado than any other state. Add that to your repertoire of useless factoids. But anyway, so he came here to enjoy the lightning. And he built a tower with lots of copper and other stuff on it. And he terrified the locals. And the main thing that he did that made him unpopular here was that he burnt out the local public utility system because he overstressed the electricity supply for the city. So eventually he got the message and left and went back east again. He was very eccentric. He probably developed wireless before Marconi, but it's locked up in his patents and he didn't have the money and the backers. Westinghouse had deserted him. He became progressively more and more curious. He began to believe in UFOs. He died in the early 1940s, a broken and a strange man, but a man of enormous genius who was associated with this city. So he was here in 1899, promoting alternating current. Palmer, when he built his powerhouse, the International Office, in 1904, still used direct current because that was the mainstream Edison type of situation. So all Palmer's electrics were direct.
That was the question that you, asked
yeah.
on the
tour. Okay.
Was what kind of current
was when
you said
yeah.
it was on the
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, okay. Good. A little bit about the paper I haven't referred to, the orange one here, the water system. We've talked of various people. I'd like to write their names up, but I won't. We've talked about the Burkhardt family. They're the flower people. We've talked about John Blair. He was the gardener. A third man who's very important in the Palmer era for this estate is Herbert Reed, R-E-I-D. Herbert Reed was the city engineer in the closing years of the last century, and he began from 1899 on till about 1906 to develop an extraordinary system of waterworks on this estate for Palmer. He was an innovator, as I think it says in the paper here. Look at the second paragraph. Engineer Reed was an innovator. He collected storm and flood waters because the surface waters were already largely owned. Some of you will know about Colorado water law. It is different from Eastern American water law. It follows the doctrine of prior appropriation. That is, if you get there first and start using it, it's yours, period. So Palmer had been buying up water rights since 1871, because when he came here, he owned this glen, but he did not own the water of Camp Creek. And that was a cause of great concern to him. But by 1900, he'd purchased what are called the senior rights on Camp Creek. And those rights are very ancient. They go back to 1864, and therefore the ditch that goes off Camp Creek just behind the cottage, down beyond our gatehouse, and goes along the side of the alfalfa reservoirs. I'd love to walk you along there. And through some earthworks there, and that's an 1864 water right, which the successors to Palmer, namely the navigators, still have title to. Very important to us, but we have to demonstrate usage, and we're not doing that. And I'm concerned for that, and we're discussing how we can use that water. Jeff Bullock would like to make an orchard down there near the cottage. We need to use our water. The first thing that would happen, and this has happened to some of our rights, is that the city water engineer publishes in the Gazette Telegraph an abandonment notice. You're not using them, we will abandon them, get rid of them. Then you have to appeal that. And then you can, if someone wants those rights, actually the people who live in Dent Valley further down Camp Creek are not particularly interested in their rights because they get city water. So they're not about to fight us. But nevertheless, we need to demonstrate our title to those rights. So we have senior rights. They're right, they're number 77 on the whole Arkansas River, which is very ancient. Anyway, back to Herbert Reed. I say in the second paragraph, he collected storm and flood waters because the surface waters were very largely owned, and he tapped into subterranean flows. Now, Camp Creek is deceptive. Third paragraph. Probably 80 to 90% of the water that ever runs through this glen is underground. So what engineer Reed did is he built in 1899 something called the phreatic ditch. How many of you are familiar with that? Very good, Mabel, and Judith and others. The phreatic ditch, first of all, the word phreatic is just from the Greek and it means subterranean, underground. Ditch is the generic word for a water conduit, even if it isn't a ditch, but it's an underground pipe. Imagine that we're walking down the glen and we're just about to go through the entrance to the glen proper, the Dakota Hogbacks. Up here's the Eagle's Nest. Here's the place where the rustic lodge was that the Burkhardts lived in. And by the way, they nearly got wiped out by a boulder that fell down in the 1920s. Then they moved to the carriage house because they were so scared of bits of Dakota falling on them. Digression, sorry. But you come down to the Dakota rocks here, and you begin to see, and you can see them there, things about this high, shaped like beehives. They're the entry points to the phreatic ditch. What is it there for? Very simple. Glen Eyrie. This is the canyon, Queens Canyon, okay? This is the South Dakota and the North Dakota hogback. Here's the eagle's nest. Forgive my drawing. Here's Glen Eyrie. Here's Camp Creek. All right? Goes down there. What is being missed is 90% of the water, which doesn't flow in the creek, but is flowing down here, down here, down here. So the phreatic ditch starts here, goes to here, and then goes down here and feeds back into these reservoirs that are now dry. You see, it captures the water running down. And that's what engineer Reed did that was very innovative. There were very few of those water systems around at that time. I think the concept was only a few years old. And so that's described in here. It's also mentioned that in the Glen Eyrie water system, there was, at maximum, a total of 18 reservoirs, a couple of 100 million gallons of storage. Why would Palmer want all of that? Well, he had a tremendous amount under cultivation. He generally believed in getting hold of all the rights that he could for all the things that were around here. I'll tell you about fatty rice in a moment. And he went into a process of acquiring more and more water than he needed. The probability, I would guess, had he lived, he was going to do some more development on places like the Mesa. But all of that water, with the exception of some water up in Blair Athol, three reservoirs up there, 15 of the reservoirs were fed off this humble-looking little creek, which is dry most of the year, thanks to Engineer Reed, as described in this paper. The glen was full of ponds, lily ponds, fish ponds, willow ponds, and they're all over there mapped out in Engineer Reed's set of drawings of what he was doing. This period from 1899 to 1906 is, of course, the strategic period in the development of the Glen Eyrie Estate, culminating in the castle in 1904, the powerhouse in 1904, the gatehouse in 1907, the gardener's cottage in 1906, but basically starting with building up the water in 1899. How could he do that? Through the sale of the Denver and Rio Grande Western in, what, 1901? That's where he got $5 million. Why did he do that? We don't know. We don't have insights into his mind. But I want to tell you that in 1904, a very seminal book was published by a man called Thorstein Veblen, V-E-B-L-E-N. The book is called The Theory of the Leisure Class. And it is the book from which we get our phrase, conspicuous consumption. Do you know that phrase? From a piece of English doggerel, let me put it this way. It is the business of the wealthy man to give employment to the artisan. There was sort of a divine responsibility on someone like General Palmer to take very seriously their position as an employment factory. 70 servants, whatever it was. And The Theory of the Leisure Class is a book by Veblen, a professional economist, establishing the importance of landlords and other wealthy people in America and elsewhere to build large buildings, to make large reservoirs, to found new cities, because that is the engine of progress. And it is important for a man like the general to be conspicuous in his consumption. The whole theory of economics came out of that. Thorstein Veblen, The Theory of the Leisure Class, 1904. And I and my friend Kurt Poulton, who's our, do you believe this? Digression. This man in Colorado Springs, Dr. Kurt Poulton, whom some of you know, he has his doctorate in Camp Creek. Isn't that nice to have a PhD in the study of Camp Creek? So you can see I'm richly endowed with people who know things, and all I have to do is write down at the appropriate time what they say. Okay. So we've talked about the water system, and I do commend this paper to you. It's got a lot of information on the reservoirs. Also, sadly, 3 years ago, we filled in the pasture reservoir. We didn't even know it was a reservoir. And I came in one morning, and the backhoe had just taken it out and spoiled the sluice. And the ones that remain, there's one precious little one up on the hillside between the international office and the maintenance shops. Are you agile enough to have visited that little reservoir? It's original. It's 1871. It's called the Orchard No. 1 Reservoir. It's about 25 feet by 20 feet. It's about 12 feet deep. If you fall into it, no one will hear you scream. It's made of kind of rough-hewn concrete, and it was his original, part of his farmer's old system for the orchards which lay where the cow barns now are. They were all apple trees. There is a white stick if you walk up the Queen's Canyon just after you cross. You balance on the pipe, sort of sticking out at an odd angle. It seems likely that that white stick indicates the level of the Orchard Reservoir, which was the original reservoir that was being fed by the system, well before the Mesa reservoirs. Okay, so we've looked at the flowers, we've looked at the reservoirs. We have 15 minutes. I will do one more thing, and then I will say what should we talk about that I haven't covered. And this is the deplorable fatty rice. I have here a letter written by General Palmer in January 1907, 3 or 4 months after his accident, to his friend Mr. Perkins. Mr. Perkins, the chairman of the Burlington Railroad and the man who in 1888 had purchased the Garden of the Gods, right? So they're neighbors. Palmer lives here, Perkins lives here. They're friends and they're both railroad men, though they have quite a correspondence from time to time. And he says, first of all, on Palmer's health, 3 months after the accident, listen to the optimism. I am not only out of danger, but on a fair way to recovery, with a reasonable hope of reasserting the functions of my legs and arms and my nerves and muscles by this spring. And so that didn't quite work out. Then Palmer has a little bit of a grumble about the Denver and Rio Grande. He said, I hear that the old Burlington Railroad, like the Rio Grande system, is not kept up to the former standard. As to the Denver and Rio Grande, if it has an engine that doesn't leak, I'm not aware of it. So he's a bit morbid about the people who purchased his railroad, although he got $6 million from them, so he shouldn't be too. I remember a few years ago when the Russ Wolf family sold their land for Mountain Shadows. There was an interview in the Gazette Telegraph with Mrs. Wolf, and she said, this is a very sad day for us. This is an awful thing that's happened to us. And then at the bottom of the article, they put how many million dollars the family got. It's not that sad. it did. I mean, the Wolf family is a tragedy. Yeah, that is true. So anyway, imagine yourself down at the Gateway Road. The Gateway Road is what goes from the visitor center into the Garden of the Gods, right? As you're going into the Garden of the Gods, you've got the Gateway Rocks just in front of you, and you have the opportunity to turn right. In fact, you're forced to turn right now, to go right around. It's a one-way system. Just before you turn right there, if you were to get out of your car, where the city doesn't allow it any longer, and you were to just walk 20 feet from the road, you'd find about a 30-foot by 40-foot, 4-foot hollow in the ground. That was the little reservoir for Mr. and Mrs. Rice, who maintained a saloon there. On that side of the road was their saloon. On the other side of the road was a shop that sold alabaster, the sort of alabaster that you can see as you drive out of the glen, a little bit down from the international office on the right, just poking out. Same formation. People collected it now, and they still do, sometimes called gypsum. Anyway, Palmer says that the point of this letter is that, I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. Man in the Garden of the Gods. Anyone seen that? Yes. You need to understand that Mr. Fatty Rice is a man of substantial girth. I'm going to pass this around, and you'll see the name is just. This is his little house, where I've just described, and this is Fatty and another substantial friend. Now, he died around 1900, and his widow resisted for 7 years Palmer's attempts to buy the little place. Palmer says here, and I want to read this, the lady, now a widow, he's talking to Perkins, lives at the western portal of the Your Shining Gateway and is better known as by the name of Mrs. Fatty Rice. I am anxious to get rid of her because it is not fitting to have a drinking place too near to any spot hallowed by association with the gods, but chiefly because of the contaminating effect upon my own employees. You remember his views on alcohol? I have discovered that none of the numerous trails, and Palmer had more than 100 miles of trails on this estate, most of them, I'm digressing again, you'll find, I could take you to them up there, they have little stones about this size, and those stones were painted with phosphorescent paint so that Palmer and his friends could ride at night and still see where they were going. Anyway, I discover that none of the numerous trails from Glen Eyrie are at all trodden as well as the beeline which leads from my glen across the hills to Mrs. Rice's store. So, I mean, he's really choked about the alcohol being consumed by his people. And by the way, we have a photograph of some of his employees in the carriage house holding bottles of various things and just kind of celebrating, you know, and showing that they weren't afraid of him. Interesting photo. He says, except your garden, Mr. Perkins, there is now no land that does not belong to me within about 2 miles in that direction from my house. And he said, I covet this Naboth's vineyard. You remember 1 Kings 21? Ahab looked out of his window and got utterly frustrated with Naboth and said, I want that vineyard. Naboth said, no, but I want it. And Palmer is identifying himself with King Ahab here. And he says, I want this little saloon. I want to get rid of it. So he's conspiring here with his friend Mr. Perkins. So how can they make a move on Mrs. Rice and buy up the saloon? But you'll see there that he was indeed Fatty Rice.
And did he get it?
Palmer got it in 1908, but just about then Mr. Perkins died, and then his children gave the land, and so there are no foundational traces, just the declivity, the water thing. Okay, I stop. Are there any questions or areas that we should touch on? Yes.
We didn't talk about money.
No. What would you like to talk about?
Just about how that all came about, the mining laws, and when they lost the rights, and then was there any opposition when they did start mining?
Let me talk about coal mining, because that relates to Palmer much more than gold mining. Two things you ought to know. One, Palmer owned some coal mines. Basically, in this city, the area from Garden of the Gods, north through Rock Rimmon, and across the interstate, is honeycombed with mines. At the peak in the 1920s, there were 77 coal mines operating in Colorado Springs. Only a trace of one remains. That is the Golden Cycle mine, which is just near the Marriott Hotel. That concrete, ugly, windowless building there is the remains of the big Golden Cycle mine which ran under Rock Rimmon. If you want to see a coal seam, drive down to the end of the Garden of the Gods, turn north on the interstate, and look up at what used until recently to be the Sunbird restaurant. Okay? You know what I mean? And not as high as that, but about 12 feet off the ground on the big piece of rock that the Sunbird stands, you'll see 6 inches of black running horizontal. That's the coal seam. That's the narrowest point of the coal seam. If you were to follow that underground towards Rock Rimmon, it does this and this and this. And Palmer had several of these mines, and they were called the Glen Eyrie Mining Company. Frustration? Drive a little north of here, and you go to the Colorado Museum of Mining. And you go in and you go to the desk and you say, can I learn about coal mining? And they look blank. They're only concerned with silver and gold. And yet Colorado, for many years, was the number one state in the nation, not only for what? Lightning, but also for coal. Tremendous coal mines. There are 47 geographical place names in the state of Colorado that have coal in them, like Coal Creek. So Palmer was involved somewhat in coal. The other thing I want to mention on mining, I'm hardly addressing your question, but I'm digressing vigorously. If you walk up Queens Canyon, and Len knows where this is, you would come to a place where a solitary miner worked from the 1880s through to 1924. He's a quite extraordinary man. His name is Lithicum, L-I-T-H-I-C-U-M. If you're interested in him, this is from a 1929 paper. and it says, "Prospector in Queens Canyon is still looking for the lost vein that he's been hunting since 1894. And this is in 1929. And Mr. Lithicum was a recluse and an eccentric. He couldn't drive, but he would come down and admire the Fords, the Model A or Model T Fords outside the castle. He kind of touched them and enjoyed them. He wasn't a married man. Yes, he was a married man. His wife lived downtown, refused to live up there. And she would send provisions up. Sometimes in the winter, he got stranded up there. But there is, in fact, blocked up, possibly by the navigators, possibly by Strake, there's a 1,200-foot tunnel leading in Queens Canyon, into this working. And did we block it up?
I don't know.
It's open. Okay, very good. Well, not very good. Again, we shouldn't talk about that. It's rather like rock climbing. But he was convinced that there was a lode or a vein, whatever it is, in Queens Canyon. It's only a little bit up there near Dorothy Falls. Palmer didn't have anything to do with the Cripple Creek Gold Rush that I'm aware of, other than receiving Chinese coolies and similar people who were thrown out of Cripple Creek.
What about the mountain behind it?
Scout on the Mountain, yes.
Yeah.
That name was given to it by the Secretary of the Interior, Maurice Udall. The company that started there started in 1954, the year after we purchased Glen Eyrie. They were very smart people out of Utah, basically, and they moved 1 year before the federal government passed a law that you couldn't do any longer the sort of mining that they do. They purchased that land, hundreds of acres, for $2.50 an acre. And they've been at it ever since until they were stopped about 3 years ago. They called it Castle Concrete because they wanted to send a signal that then were neighbors with the castle. And of course, they have damaged or had damaged our viewscape. They were, and I've got an extensive article on this if you want to read it, they were a source of controversy in the city right from the beginning because of the ugliness of what they were doing. As individuals, they're good people. They have some wine, I've been to their office and looked at photos of the Glen and so on. But, and we have had an incestuous relationship with them, I would say, looking at it from the outside. They have supplied rock for places like the U.S. Administration Building, and we have allowed them a right of way past that building onto their land. They have built dams and water barrages for us, such as the one up the Box Canyon, to stop water coming down through those canyons, and we have continued to give them the right of way. So I don't think our record as environmentally conscious neighbors has been that honorable, at least until recently. So, yeah, and I have a lot more about that.
Now, did Palmer ever own that property?
No.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I don't think.
Oh, it is federal.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. It's leased from the federal government. And the problem in Colorado has been that the Land Reclamation Commission, that may not be the exact title, has been staffed and their board have been all miners.
Yeah.
So it's an awkward situation where they're not about to discipline their own competitors, as it were.
It's odd that he didn't own it, though, isn't it? Palmer from the beginning or not? Or there was no use for it? Or?
I don't know. He used to call the canyon just beyond this Little Glen Eyrie, and they had picnics there when they didn't go as far north as as Blair Athol. But I don't know, Len, do you, why he didn't own that? No. That's a good thing to say. Any other questions? If there are areas, and there will be many, I'm sure, that you have things that you would like to tell me, you know, not necessarily now, but in the course of the next month, that's why I put my card in there so that you could just call me. I'd love to collect more data. I have a very patient assistant. And, okay, so it's 11:27. I think we'll stop and we'll go back to Len now. Good enough?